Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University. You are listening to On the Environment, a podcast series from the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy. For more information, visit the website at envirocenter.yale.edu.
I'm Lucy Kessler, a Master's of Environmental Management candidate at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, and I'm pleased to welcome Mr. James Cameron to the studio today. Mr. Cameron is an executive fellow with the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy and is one of the world's preeminent experts in policy responses to climate change. Mr. Cameron is partner at Systemic and was previously vice chairman of Climate Change Capital, where he was responsible for strategic and sector development. Thank you very much for joining us today, Mr. Cameron.
Pleasure. Thank you.
So, James, you served for a number of years as vice chairman of the company Climate Change Capital, which in 2006 launched the world's largest private sector carbon fund. What is a private sector carbon fund and what does it do?
At Climate Change Capital, we had an idea. I was one of the founders of Climate Change Capital, and having spent years working on the law and policy that created incentives for investment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it was clear that we needed to aggregate capital and deploy it directly in projects that were rewarded for the value of reducing greenhouse gas emissions anywhere in the world. And that was done principally through, at that time, the Clean Development Mechanism, which was the product of the Kyoto Protocol, which I negotiated with the Alliance of Small Island States, and Article 12 in particular, which provided the basic rules for the establishment of the Clean Development Mechanism, which in turn provided opportunity for capital to flow into developing countries to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in order to aid the compliance by developed countries of their obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. And the other legal medium for doing this was the European Emissions Trading System. And having helped construct that with my colleagues at Baker & McKenzie, providing advice to the European Commission, it was clear that the rules that had been established to incentivize reductions of greenhouse gas emissions needed capital to flow in order to make good those commitments. And at the time we created Climate Change Capital, there wasn't a lot around that could do that work effectively and efficiently. And so together with others, we had a go at creating our own fund. And what that means is that private money, which comes from pension funds, aggregated into a structure, fund structure, had the capacity to deliver public goods, i.e. reducing greenhouse gas emissions, because, done well, there was an opportunity for financial return. Mm-hmm. And that's what a private sector carbon fund is. But I actually want to emphasize something is a little strange in that there really isn't much difference actually in the end between public and private money for these purposes. Mm-hmm. Because either the money is taxpayers' money going through a government and being parceled up into a development bank or a strategy that a government department implements with finance, mm-hmm. or It all comes from us, or it's sent to a pension fund via a pension plan. It's savings money and is trying to prepare for a retirement one day and looking for a financial return.
Right.
What's interesting about what we did is put the two together, mm-hmm. and use private money to deliver a public good of reducing greenhouse gas emissions under the law.
Could you talk to us a little bit about what you would envision for putting a price on carbon, and if you would say if this is like a preferred method or what you would suggest about kind of how that would work?
I firmly believe that putting a price on carbon is essential, but it's not a panacea, and there are several ways to do it. I prefer the notion of carbon value, i.e. by understanding the science of climate change, you know the value of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. If your economy can value the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions in everything it does, in all the millions of decisions it takes every day, in commerce, in business, in industry, then you have the potential for a transformational shift in your economy so that it doesn't continue to cause harm to the atmosphere. And so choosing the right devices for system change matter, and putting a price on carbon is one of those devices. Mm-hmm. You have to choose the right one for your political economy, for your legal order. There isn't a universal price, but markets do tend to scale. And when they scale, they do so partly because things have been standardized enough for you to be able to measure a ton of carbon reduced in the same way anywhere in the world and trade in such a way as a price can be established anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And scale matters. Mm-hmm. So getting things to scale matters because it's a really, really big problem.
Yeah.
It's less effective to have a very discrete system that only one country or one province or one town adopts. Mm-hmm. But we've learned now, I think, that it's very hard to push people too hard into choosing an economic method like this, a metric, that they don't understand or don't feel they can apply. There are compromises that have to be made. Mm-hmm. And sometimes plain old regulation produces a value for carbon. It doesn't always need to be a market mechanism. But, mm-hmm. but in our messy democracies with our complex economic system, you should not assume that the government will always know what the right method for reducing greenhouse gas emissions is, mm-hmm. or what the right price is if they choose a tax as a method. A marketplace is more likely to discover the right price, feed information back rapidly, and increase the learning process. And we need that. We need quite high levels of experimentation, rapid learning and adjustment, and the price has to be discovered by doing the various tasks to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Interesting. So we talked a little bit about price on carbon and your work with the Carbon Fund. Are there other financial solutions that exist to help address climate change and other resource management challenges?
Yes, I mean, let's just take the ways in which you influence the flow of capital. Clearly, taxing carbon is a device mm-hmm. that works. Taxing fossil fuels themselves directly at the pump is a way mm-hmm. of affecting decisions on the use of fossil fuels, which are central to dealing with the climate change problem. There are a long, long list of measures you can choose. If you can get them through your legislature, you can choose a whole range of ways in which you can reduce greenhouse gas emissions in every sector of the economy, mm-hmm. in agriculture, in industry, in transport, in procurement. The government is a very, very substantial consumer. If you change the procurement rules for government, and indeed the U.S. government is doing that, you can make choices that reduce greenhouse gas emissions routinely in your administrative processes. The fleets of cars and trucks that you choose and what engines that they have and what fuels they use. I mean, all of these things are devices. Mm-hmm. But the financial markets have other ways in which behaviors are formed that are nothing to do with climate change but would make a difference. How are fund managers compensated? What are the horizons for their investment returns? How short-run, short-term are their investment decisions? Mm-hmm. What are the ways in which decisions get made to deploy capital in big pension funds? Do they allocate enough to innovation and risk capital, which is essential for any transformation? You can't expect the economy to change sufficiently to cope with climate change mm-hmm. unless you innovate. You know, carrying on with the same technologies can't do it. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there will be a disruption to our economy. Who funds that disruption matters, and also people will win as well as lose from that disruption. So where are the great new technologies? Who's going to develop those? Who invests in those? Those things are critical. And so a pension fund that allocates very little to private equity and venture capital is unlikely to benefit from that disruption.
hundreds of businesses endorsed putting a price on carbon ahead of COP21 in Paris. Even the chief of Unilever, Paul Polman, has stated achieving a zero emissions economy is the greatest business opportunity of the century. Would you agree with Mr. Polman? And why is acting on climate change a wise business decision?
I do agree with Paul, and he's been a great figurehead for business action on climate change, along with others that have joined organizations like We Mean Business, and indeed in my new organization, Systemic, we work with Paul and others in the Business Commission on Sustainable Development and the Energy Transition Commission. And you see in those enterprises, same with the new climate economy and the new plastic economy, and these various ways of businesses collaborating with others, with experts, with government, with NGOs, think tanks, to try and figure out how to make this transition happen and profit from it in a way which is attractive for employees, other stakeholders, and where business can be a clear and obvious ally in that necessary transformation, delivering public good as well as private gain. But it's also true that there will be losers from that transition, and capitalist economies are brutal in that respect, and no sympathy should be had for those that will lose out from the great transition that we've got to make. There will be a disruption, as I said before, and that disruption mean that folks who have economic and financial power today will lose, and they'll be replaced by those who have solutions to this climate change problem that are attractive and alluring. And that's one thing I like about Paul's message and others like him, entrepreneurs in particular. I crave the company of entrepreneurs because they're naturally optimistic. And they don't see this transformation that we must make because of climate change as being a threat. They use the word opportunity and they mean it. They don't see life getting worse having solved the problem. They see increased well-being. They see better products, better services. I like the idea that we might innovate our way out of this. Well, we're going to have to. We might as well do it in a way that creates amenity, makes people feel as if they're in a community that functions effectively. There's nothing attractive about waste. And so I like the circular economy solutions. I like the fact that we can be so much better at converting primary energy into usable energy. I like the fact that we have the potential to transform our economy so it's not just greener but fairer, that the resources we have are more evenly shared and distributed. I like those kinds of transformations, and you need positive, optimistic, confident leaders in all walks of life, including in business, to make that a real transformation.
Yeah, absolutely. I would like to ask you a little bit about stranded assets. As we've heard from the IPCC, if we're to avoid the worst effects of climate change by limiting global temperature increases to no more than 2 degrees Celsius, then as much as 80% of the reserves already counted as assets by fossil fuel companies will have to stay in the ground. What risk do stranded assets pose to investors, and how do we address this?
Stranded assets is a real economic and finance industry issue that is now in focus. I mean, the work of Carbon Tracker and the Smith School of Enterprise Environment at Oxford, these networks of highly skilled analysts, often who have covered the fossil fuel industry when in investment banks or in the brokers in the city in London and elsewhere, they're the ones who are sounding the alarm. And they're doing it for very simple financial reasons first. And then, of course, they're attaching themselves to an argument that says we cannot afford, from an environment point of view, to burn the reserves that are currently counted as assets. And so if we don't burn them, they cease to become assets, they become liabilities. And have we factored that in the price that we pay for stock in these companies? To which the answer is no, we have not. And therefore we should, and the price should be different. And then all kinds of things flow from that. You know, our capital markets are very heavily automated. Tracker funds are huge suppliers, directors of flows of our savings. And that automation works off indices. Where you are in the index matters. If you slip out of the index, it really matters. So if over time these big fossil fuel companies fall down the index because they're just not valued as much, they get less flow of that capital. They have a lower ownership base. Their cost of capital goes up. So we currently have no rivals to them in clean energy, right? There's no clean energy major. There's no top of the index clean energy company, but there will be. And there will be one with no stranded assets, no legacy liability. And that'll be a really attractive investment to switch into. They'll have to switch when they feel comfortable that the entity is big enough and secure enough to produce a similar kind of profile, and they don't have that option today, I grant you. Mm-hmm. So the invest-divest movement or the divest-invest movement has to face that fact. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. If you're going to decarbonize your portfolio today, you're not going to be able to substitute fossil fuels directly with an alternative energy company. It would be something else that produces the right kind of yield. The big fossil fuel companies, they're all thinking how they manage this. And if you own the bonds or you've got project finance into some of these facilities, which are expensive to run, you're thinking about it. Now, I got to say that, and this is important, fossil fuels are remarkable substances. We are heavily dependent upon them because they're really good at doing what we want. We use them all the time in many ways. Substituting for them is not remotely easy. And you need to be sure that the substitute's better, not just greener. It fulfills the function we want. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, renewables will win on cost. But fossil fuels make all sorts of other things, mm-hmm. and we need their substitutes in chemicals and in other types of fuel that we use to move our economy along, and we'll need to find better alternatives than we currently have.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that encouragement that we need to make sure that we have a smooth lifestyle transition as well, that we can find things that are
disruptions uncomfortable for everybody. Yeah. Right. And I don't want people to think that it's okay to tear down the fossil fuel industry and then, well, what? Mm-hmm. Hope. Right. No, the fossil fuel industry knows that it's in the crosshairs. There are leaders within it that want to change. There are leaders who do not. Mm-hmm. And I've got no sympathy for those who finish up on the wrong side of this big dislocation. Mm-hmm. Right? And I'm infuriated by those who have spent their shareholder money. The people who own the business have funded years of obfuscation and disruption in the political and legal process so that we are behind the clock. And I have no time for those people.
Mm-hmm. As of next week, November 4th, the Paris Climate Agreement will enter into force. Are you optimistic about this agreement? And what concerns do you have about the framework, if any?
So I describe myself as a paradoxical optimist. I am optimistic, but I don't look away from what's difficult. I'm very proud that the Paris Agreement has come into force. I think it's pretty remarkable. It's been quick. It tells you something about the structure. It was a structure that was attractive for people to agree to and bring into force, but it's also inadequate for dealing with the problem. So you have to invest enormous trust and hope in a system that enables contributions to be put forward from all around the world. That's a good thing. We haven't artificially divided the world up into developed and developing. We haven't pretended all of the answers are going to come from the north and the west that created the problem in the first place. And we now have the whole world engaged in an enterprise of a gradual improvement. But we're heading towards a 4-degree world, despite the fact we've committed ourselves to a less than 2-degree world and preferably a 1.5-degree world. So we have to commit wholeheartedly to the structure and promise of this agreement, which is to improve progressively, to increase ambition year on year, to review progress, and to build an organization that's capable of pulling in the best resources wherever they are in the world, whether they're publicly or privately held, whether they're at the city level or at the national level, whether they're through cooperations between industries in a sector, or they're a newly created not-for-profit public goods organization fixing a really complex problem of land management somewhere, building resilience in an ecosystem. All of those options are now available. We've got to learn how to bring them together in a new process after the Paris Agreement has entered into force. And Marrakesh, which we're just about to get to, is the first event after this new era has started. It's going to be very interesting to see whether the negotiators can change their patterns of behavior and whether the non-state actors that have been welcomed in can work constructively, cooperatively with governments and get things done and get the finance moving into the right place, the right quality of finance to deliver this very important and vital objective for humanity.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Cameron. This has been a great conversation. I've learned so much today, and I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me and for your involvement with the greater Yale community.
Well, thank you very much for asking me, Lucy, and I look forward to working with everybody associated with this program, and it's been a pleasure.
Excellent. Thanks.
The views and opinions expressed by the interviewers and interviewees as part of On the Environment do not necessarily reflect the views of the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy, its affiliated faculty, staff, or supporters.